At least two people are shot dead in Sudan as hundreds of thousands in Khartoum protest against the military coup. The Arab League expresses concerns about the deterioration of ties between Persian Gulf Arab states and Lebanon following a Lebanese minister's remarks about the war in Yemen. And Chancellor Angela Merkel sounds the alarm over the return of certain recklessness as COVID infections and death rates surge in Germany. Thanks so much for being with us. First story takes us to Sudan this hour, where at least two people have been killed during anti-coup protests in the city of Omdurman. The Central Committee of Sudanese Doctors says the two died from gunshot wounds. Demonstrations are currently underway across the country to demand a civilian-led government. Sudanese security forces were deployed in large numbers in the capital, Khartoum, closing the majority of main roads and bridges. Phone lines were also largely down. Last Monday, the military detained Sudan's civilian leadership, dissolved the government, and declared a state of emergency. The coup was met with the chorus of international condemnation. At least 13 protesters have been killed in clashes with security forces. Political analyst Jonathan Afansa says, given the internal pressure and demonstrations, the military will likely reach an arrangement with the ousted civilian government in Sudan.
The situation is a bit fluid, but I believe with the pressure, with the internal pressure, especially with the demonstrations by the Sudanese people, and also some pressure from some external pressures from the U.S., from the allies of Sudan in the Middle East and elsewhere, we believe that the junta led by General Burhan will eventually try and dialogue with, you know, the ousted civilian regime and come to some sort of acceptable arrangement for the country. Already, General Burhan has promised a new civilian cabinet within 1 week. And it's also made overtures to the deposed Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok, who is insisting that he will not enter into any dialogue with the junta until the coup is renounced. And I believe Hamdok wouldn't have made such a statement if he felt that he was would be negotiating from a weak position. So I believe, it is my belief, that in due course the trend will be reversed and we'll see a restoration of a civilian interim administration in the country.
Well, the Arab League has expressed deep concern about worsening ties between Persian Gulf Arab states and Lebanon amid a row over the Saudi war on Yemen. Well, the organization has warned against any measures that would negatively affect Lebanon's ailing economy. It has also urged Beirut to act quickly to ease the tensions. In a recent interview, Lebanon's information minister called the Saudi-led war on Yemen futile and demanded an end to it. George Khodai also said Yemen's Ansar Allah forces are only defending their country against external aggression. Now, the kingdom and its regional allies have taken a series of punitive measures against Beirut over Khodai's remarks. In the latest escalation, Kuwait has ordered Lebanon's charge d'affaires to leave the country.
Saudi Arabia has ordered the Lebanese ambassador to the country to leave over what the kingdom refers to as offensive remarks by the Lebanese information minister regarding the ongoing war by Saudi-led coalition against Yemen. Saudi Arabia has also imposed a ban on all imports from Lebanon. At the same time, the Saudi Foreign Ministry has expressed regret over the deteriorating relations between Riyadh and Beirut, accusing Lebanon of ignorance and failure to take corrective measures to improve the bilateral ties between the two countries. All these came amid a call by Lebanese Information Minister George Kordahi for an end to the Saudi-sponsored war on Yemen, a devastating war with a simultaneous siege that have been killing and displacing Yemenis for more than 6 years now, a catastrophe that even the United Nations refers to as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Recently, the kingdom also classified a Beirut-based financial charity body as a terrorist entity, froze all the association's assets, and banned all sorts of financial transactions with it, all for the charity's ties with Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah. Lebanon-Saudi relations have been in free fall for years, but the kingdom's flagrant interference in Lebanon's internal affairs has intensified in the past few years. The highlight of that would be the unexpected resignation of Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri during a trip to Riyadh under Saudi degrading treatment and pressure. A year before that, Hariri had reached a power-sharing deal with Hezbollah and had attempted to convince Riyadh of the need to work with the resistance group. In 2016, Saudi Arabia halted $1 billion worth of aid to the Lebanese army, citing the country's regional ties. Those are followed by the latest series of Saudi sanctions against Lebanon, including the prohibition of its citizens from traveling to the country. However, Riyadh does not always act alone. Similar to its conduct in Yemen with regional allies and under Western support, it pressures some other Persian Gulf countries, sometimes through threats and sometimes through leverages, to fill in its footsteps. After controversy over Hariri's resignation, Kuwait and the UAE joined the kingdom to urge their citizens to leave Lebanon. The UAE, Bahrain, and Kuwait all summoned their envoys in Lebanon in protest to the recent statements of the Lebanese Information Minister. In 2017, the very same group of countries, alongside Egypt, collectively severed their ties with Qatar, citing a variety of reasons, including support for terrorism or Qatar's backing of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, allegations that were all strongly rejected by Doha.
I believe that people will raise their voices inside and outside Saudi Arabia, and they cannot win a war in which they kill people for speaking out their mind. This is they should stop this policy and come stop the war, stop the hooliganism, and stop the attacks on neighboring countries and on their own citizens. That's the best for everyone.
Therefore, one can say that the current Saudi measures against Lebanon, especially at the time of heightened economic instability and insecurity, would do nothing but deteriorate the already worsening crises in the Arab country.
Now it's time for this hour's news review. Russia has a word of caution for participants on the upcoming talks in Vienna aimed at restoring the 2015 nuclear deal. Russia's top negotiators warning against any move which can complicate the resumption and successful completion of the negotiations. Mikhail Ulyanov made the call in a tweet following a fresh round of U.S. sanctions against Iran, this time targeting its drone program. Tehran has slammed the move as contradictory to the U.S. administration's claims that it wants to rejoin the nuclear deal. The former U.S. administration left the deal in tatters after abandoning it in 2018 and reimposing anti-Iran sanctions. In an effort to revive the agreement, Iran and the remaining parties to the deal have held several rounds of negotiations, which are set to resume by the end of November. Iran insists the talks will be successful only if they lead to the removal of sanctions. I'd like to welcome my guests to this news review. Marcus Papadopoulos, author and historian out of London. I mean, what do you make of this? On the one hand, Iran had talked to some of the parties and said it was willing to return to sit and talk. of course, dealing with the same structure of before and not renegotiating anything new. That happened, and then we saw the United States then sanctioning, actually, Iran now this time around for drones and drone technology. I mean, what do you make of this? Do you think that the U.S. really wants to return to the deal or not?
Well, firstly, Joe Biden has no intention whatsoever of returning America to the JCPOA. After all, Biden is a self-professed Zionist, which means that he, in particular, has no love, no affection, no respect for the Iranian Revolution, which freed the Iranian people from Western subjugation. I said time and time again on television and in speeches from the very moment, from the very day that Biden took office, that those commentators, those analysts who were arguing that America could return to the JCPOA under Biden never corroborated their contentions with any evidence at all. Secondly, by America, whoever is sitting in the White House, be it Biden, be it a Trump, or be it whoever will succeed Biden, America will use the argument, it's very, very weak and unsubstantiated argument, that Iran has not fulfilled its obligations as set out under the JCPOA in order to intensify Washington's economic war against Iran. Because all objective commentators, all impartial analysts have made it abundantly clear that Iran has fully complied with its obligations under the JCPOA. But as I said, by America alleging the opposite, that provides a very convenient cover to policymakers in Washington to increase, to intensify sanctions on Iran by simply saying to the American public and to other publics in the world that Iran is in breach of a very major treaty and therefore sanctions have to be placed. But the reality of it is this. Will these sanctions have an adverse effect on the Iranian economy, on Iranian military technological development? I very much doubt so. Why? Because Iran has a strategic partnership with Russia, and Russia, of course, is a superpower. Furthermore, Iran has a very close political, economic, and military relationship with China.
And on that note, I'd like to thank you for being with me for this news review out of London. Marcus Papadopoulos, author and historian. The leaders of the world's most advanced nations are arriving in the Italian capital of Rome to attend the G20 summit there. Climate change, health, and the relaunch of the global economy top the agenda of the two-day talks. The participants are under pressure to make headway on tackling global warming. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has warned G20 leaders to show more action to overcome mistrust to advance climate goals. Well, the event comes amid protests and inaction to address the problems of climate change. On Friday, thousands of school students staged a rally calling on the G20 summit to deal with the crisis. Other groups, including the charity Oxfam, also held a flash mob in Rome. They demanded world leaders in global inequity of access to coronavirus vaccines and treatment.
About 4,000 high school students took to the streets of the Italian capital to stage a rally against the upcoming G20 summit of world leaders. Pupils from secondary schools called on the summit's participants to stop the injustices that, quote, have led the planet to the climate crisis and invest significantly in public education as a way to give them a future. The G20 summit will reportedly focus on climate change, health, and the global economic recovery.
We already know for sure that the world leaders will not opt to invest in public health, social welfare, or in fixing the climate crisis. Quite the contrary, their resolutions will be taken in support of banks and large multinationals.
We are here because our school system is on its knees. Public education must be a priority. World leaders must understand it.
Also on Friday, charities Oxfam, Amnesty International and Emergency held a flash mob in Rome's city centre demanding world leaders to end global inequality of access to vaccines and coronavirus treatments. According to charities representatives, billions of people around the world are denied access to COVID vaccine because big pharmas are actively blocking other manufacturers from producing much-needed doses and continue to prioritize selling vaccines to rich countries.
The situation is very serious because in low-income countries at the moment, less than 2% of the population have been fully vaccinated, while in high-income countries the average is more than 60%.
A large security operation will be enforced with a 10 square kilometer maximum security area in the Eur Quarter, the district surrounding the Congress Center where the G20 summit is taking place. The authorities are wary of the danger that anti-vax extremists and black blocs may pose if they infiltrate the protests. Airspace is closed over Rome and border controls have been enhanced in the attempt to keep away violent protesters.
The G20 summit kicks off on Saturday. Up to 6,000 police officers along with 500 soldiers will be deployed in the Italian capital as authorities fear violent demonstrations during the meeting. Max Civili, Rome.
Meanwhile, the vaccination campaign is gaining momentum in Iran, with over 52 million people having received the first dose of the jab. Health authorities say over 33 million are now fully vaccinated. More than 84,000 people have also received the booster. Iran is now among the top 20 countries to have offered COVID jabs per capita. This has caused COVID-related figures to go down, with authorities reporting 123 daily fatalities on Friday, the lowest in almost 4 months. On Saturday, however, 128 new deaths were posted. Nearly 7,000 new cases were also diagnosed. Iran has logged 126,000 deaths and nearly 6 million cases in all. And now to Germany, where the chancellor has expressed alarm over the recent surge in coronavirus infections and deaths in her country. 21,500 new infections and 90 related deaths were reported on Saturday. Health officials also registered a 40% jump in COVID-related hospitalizations since last week. Chancellor Merkel says the high number of hospitalizations is worrisome, citing recklessness among Germans as the cause. Health professionals blame the spike in hospitalizations on low vaccination rates. 65% of a recent survey opposed vaccinations, and another 23% were reluctant to receive the jab. So far, around 66% of the German population has been vaccinated. And with that, brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Huge spending on the military has undermined U.S. economic growth. Increased spending on defense meant less funding allocated to education and other socio-economic programs. This misallocation of resources was a major reason the U.S. economy was slowing down, made worse by COVID-19 pandemic and the trade war between United States and China. We're prepared for you an article written by Ken Moak. Ken Moak taught economic theory, public policy, and globalization at university level for 33 years. The article is titled, Why Majority of Americans Support Costly Foreign Policies. The article has been published by the Asia Times Daily. Democrats and Republicans may be at each other's throats when it comes to domestic policy, spending, and the size of U.S. government. But they are on the same page on foreign policies, protecting American supremacy or stifling any country that is in a position to challenge U.S. interests. In doing so, the U.S. government has spent lavishly and demanded that its allies do the same to stifle the purported China-Russia threat. Former President Donald Trump renamed the Asia-Pacific region Indo-Pacific, increasing Freedom of Navigation Operations, or FONOPs, and reviving the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, or Quad. Donald Trump also demanded that NATO allies increase defense spending to 2% of their gross domestic product, or GDP. Current President Joe Biden not only carried on with Donald Trump's foreign policies on China and Russia, but has in fact intensified them. Joe Biden wanted to formalize and expand the Quad into a military alliance that would include South Korea, Vietnam, and others. However, huge spending on the military has undermined U.S. economic growth. Increased spending on defense meant less funding allocated to education and other socio-economic programs. This misallocation of resources was a major reason the U.S. economy was slowing down, made worse by the COVID-19 pandemic and U.S.-China trade wars. Escalating tensions in the Asia-Pacific region and politicizing the origins of COVID-19 have worsened the security environment, climate warming, and the pandemic. Holding frequent Freedom of Navigation Operations, or FONOPs, in the Asia-Pacific region has triggered an arms race of some sort between the United States and China. Each country is spending more and more on weapons development and weapons production. The freedom of navigation operations and China's tit-for-tat response have a real possibility of turning the situation into a hot war. Costly and dangerous as U.S. foreign policies are, still the majority of the American public support them. For example, most American farmers, the most harmed by the trade wars, supported Donald Trump and his China policies because they wrongly believe China is a threat to U.S. national interests. This raises the question, why do most Americans support these self-inflicting harmful policies? One answer is that the so-called yellow peril narrative is not far below the skin for many Americans, believing China is a national economic and national security threat. Another is the role of groups that benefit from confrontational policies. U.S. foreign policies have turned out to be hugely profitable not only for the military-industrial complex, but also for the financial institutions, for the think tanks and the media. For example, weapons producers require large loans from banks to fulfill contractual obligations. Publishing subjective news about adversaries increased readership. Think tanks and pundits received large rewards to spin the anti-Chinese rhetoric, so there is real incentive for these groups to cheer and to lobby the government to implement confrontational policies. A case in point is how the military-industrial complex has succeeded in inventing an enemy, shaping public policies by manipulating public opinion against it, making generous election campaign donations to both major political parties, and dispersing weapons production across the country. In the aftermath of the Second World War, the United States turned against the Soviet Union, accusing it of expanding wrong ideology to Europe and to the world. The United States first instituted the Marshall Plan, showering countries with money that were willing to toe the line on American values and ideals. The recipients were also required to spend the funds on U.S. goods and services. The United States then established the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, a military alliance composed of democratic Western nations to counter Soviet Union. The formation of NATO proved profitable for the military-industrial complex because it could not only sell arms to the United States, but to its allies as well. However, spending more on defense against a perceived enemy undermined economic growth at home because less was allocated to education and to other socio-economic programs. At the same time, escalated tensions with the former Soviet Union heightened the security risk in Europe and at home. The Soviet Union responded with the establishment of the Warsaw Pact, a military club consisting of itself and Eastern European countries. The conflicts between US and Western Europe and the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe led to the Cold War, under which both sides spent huge amounts of money on defense. The collapse of the former Soviet Union thus brought joy to Americans because it was supposed to generate a peace dividend. They thought the money that was being spent on weapons would be reallocated to education, to healthcare, and employment creation programs. However, the opposite was true. Instead of bringing economic growth, the economy slowed down. This was because the states that depended on defense spending, such as California, turned into economic basket cases. Furthermore, declining military spending hurts the bottom line of the military-industrial complex, forcing them to lay off workers. To reverse the economic and financial misfortunes, an enemy had to be created. China became the ideal candidate because it was Asian, and most important of all, in a position to challenge America's hegemony in almost, if not all, fields. China's successful economy with Chinese characteristics, development, architecture allowed the country to become a near peer power to the United States. The Asian power was able to reject the U.S.-imposed world order and compete with the United States in most, if not all, fields, including in technology and military. China's rise was unacceptable to both the U.S. Democrats and U.S. Republicans, in that foreign policies were configured to maintain global dominance and protect national security. What's more, politicians on both sides of the political divide were obligated to defend the military-industrial complex's interests. Politicians, particularly those sitting on the Congressional Armed Services Committees and representing weapons-producing states, received generous campaign donations from the military-industrial complex. This was meant to influence the lawmakers to make favorable decisions. It worked, as the overly bloated U.S. defense budget of more than $750 billion attests. The politicians gained because they were seen as bringing home the bacon or looking after the nation's interests. Increasing weapons purchases translated into greater economic and employment opportunities. Anti-China politicians were also seen as the so-called patriots, defending America from its enemies, though no country has ever threatened the United States. Demonizing China was largely responsible for Donald Trump winning the White House race in 2016. Anti-China and anti-Russia sentiments were manipulated by politicians with the help of the media and pundits. For instance, the Washington Post published the allegation that the coronavirus had caused the COVID-19 pandemic was actually leaked from Wuhan Institute of Virology, without bothering to verify the claim. The same was true on other issues. The media and pundits kept on accusing the Chinese government of committing genocide and forced labor in Xinjiang without any credible evidence. Indeed, it could be argued that the charges did not make much sense and were contrary to what was happening on the ground. So there is no surprise that U.S. politicians, senior officials, and even presidents acted as arms salesmen, influencing allies and friends to buy American-made weapons against China and other like-minded governments. As indicated earlier, weapons manufacturing is big business, at least for the few that benefited directly from it. Whether U.S. confrontational foreign policies serve the national interest would depend on one's perspective. But there is evidence to suggest that these policies have heightened national security risks, undermined economic growth, widened the gap between the rich and the poor, and increased poverty. The trade wars with China have worsened U.S. economic woes, increasing production costs and consumer prices. Worse, the U.S. trade deficit with China has actually increased and manufacturing activities decreased, the very reasons for the trade wars. Focusing on war and aggression instead of education and healthcare has diluted the quality and productiveness of the American labor force. In the era of globalization, this is a no-no because poor quality and unhealthy workers will not be able to compete in the world market.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Today we are blessed to have Sheikh Ahmed Hanif, who will delve into the topic of sex and gender in Islam. Sheikh Ahmed Hanif is a Canadian Shia scholar who studied both in the classical university system in Canada and the traditional Hausa system in Qom, Iran. He studied political science, psychology, and social work at York University and McMaster University, and specialized in Islamic philosophy in the Hausa Ilmiya in Qom, Iran.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Love is something that dominates us. It dominates both men and women. And because that love dominates us, we tend to all have a feminine type of relationship with love. Love becomes the dominant, and we become the receivers of that influence of love. When we have marriage that takes place out of the interrelationship of that love, that marriage is something that is, we can call it sacred. Let's call it sacred. Indeed, in the Christian church, they consider marriage a sacrament. A sacrament is a holy act or a holy state that is sanctioned by God. And it's for this reason that in the Catholic Church, in the traditional Catholic Church, they did not conceive of divorce. Why they didn't conceive of divorce is because they saw this relationship between a man and a woman as a divinely ordained act. Now in Islam, the act of marriage is seen as a contract, is performed as a contract. Nevertheless, the state of marriage in Islam is exactly similar to the state of marriage in Christianity, in the sense that the state of marriage is an opening to an opportunity for deeper spiritual realization. You know, so we've heard of the many hadith that say, for example, the prayer of a married person, like the salah of a married person, is 70 times greater than that of a non-married person. Or the sleep of a married person in the month of Ramadan is deeper in terms of spiritual significance than a non-married person staying up all night and worshiping. What does it mean? Well, you know, for us to grow in spirituality, we have to be more godlike. When we share in the characteristics of God, we become more godlike, and it's affinity. It is affinity that is something that leads to connection. And when we say godlike, what do we mean? Well, you know, if you are unjust, you cannot come close to God, because Allah is just. You know, if you are not, you know, tawab, always seeking Allah in terms of repentance for our sins, you know, we do not correspond with Allah as a tawab, the one who often turns to us whenever we turn to Him. You know, if we are not merciful, then we cannot be have affinity with God, who is all merciful. And so to arrive at deeper realization of our spiritual opportunities, we have to be godlike. The married person is more godlike than the unmarried person. Why? Because that married person is in the process, or in the state of the rejoining of the two halves of humanity, which is the male and the female, or the Adamic side and the Edenic side, the Eve side. The Hawaii side, one could probably call it, you know, that we overcome our halfness, so to speak, our incompleteness. And so when we complete ourselves in marriage, we are like, in a sense, in a limited sense, in a human sense, more godlike, in the sense that we are now complete, like God is perfect and complete in His own realm. So marriage is a very, very, very important thing in Islam. Very, very important. Who you marry, you know, has some kind of, you know, existential effect upon you, on that person's personality. We inherit from our parents not only our physical traits, but we also inherit many of our nervous traits, or many of our personality traits. And this is why it becomes very important who you marry. You know, so this is why the family's role in the choice of a mate is much more important and much more profound than, for example, say, in a secular environment like this, which is based upon pure individualism, and therefore nobody has any right or nobody has any say in who one marries. You see, because I love X, X love me, and that's about that. Whereas in Islam, it says no. What you investigate before you decide on marriage is the family that person comes from. You know, what kind of traits are present in that family that the other people have seen, and they can tell you about it, and so forth. And you know, this is you know, the role of genes. What Islam is recognizing here as you know, a role to play in the family. And so, for example, in terms of the forbidden groups of people that one cannot marry, they include people, all of whom, if you intermarry with them, you would lead to a greater destruction of the genetic pool, and you know, the strength of the community. And we have to keep this in mind. You know, now you think about it. Let's say, for example, somebody out of a whole number of years of inbreeding, you know, somebody who is weak, and somebody who is not well balanced, would you put that person to join or try to train them to run in the Olympics and compete with other people? No, that person would not stand a chance, all right, because of that inbreeding that takes place. Well, on more subtle levels, you find the same thing occurs on probably even a deeper level on when we talk about the role of the person of illegitimate birth in Islam. You know, when we say illegitimate birth, we mean a person who does not know their father, and nobody knows their father in terms of a relationship with their mother, okay? This could be the product of, for example, let's say a one-night stand that we have in this particular society, you know? And then you have these commands in Islam that says such a person cannot lead prayer. And there's some people who get really upset about this. You know, what did that poor child do for you to exclude them? Well, what did that poor child do when you were inbreeding that now you want him to go join in the Olympics to win a medal? Would anybody accept him to do this with their deficiencies? Definitely not. Is it that child's fault? It is not. But there's an objective function that child can play, that if that child is in the wrong function, it could spell some kind of disaster for the society. Similarly, it is the case with this. You know, it's not about discrimination. It's not about injustice. No, the injustice goes back to the parents themselves. That's the injustice, which leads to a child that could be deficient in something. It's like, you know, you take a thalidomide, you know, remember those days in the 60s, they were taking these pills to deal with the sickness that comes with pregnancy, you know, morning sicknesses, right? They would take these pills, but these pills had a very negative effect upon the embryos of these people. These were the thalidomide pills, and so what happened? Kids would be born with like flippers instead of hands. You know, many of them would be lacking limbs, and so forth and so on. You know, whose fault is that? Whose fault is this? It is the parents' fault or the society's fault that put these pills upon them. So when we say, for example, you know, the person of illegitimate birth cannot lead prayer, you know, what we are talking about is that prayer, the leading of prayer requires certain criteria. You know, and a lot, many of these criteria or some of these criteria are in the background or are in the foundations of that particular person. This is what we are talking about. Just like, for example, in Sharia Islam, you know, we talk about imamat. An imama is something that requires somebody to be pure, somebody to be guided by God in order to guide us. And on a lower level, imama on prayer requires certain stringent requirements to make that communal prayer viable and take that prayer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And any kind of deficiency, you know, like, for example, coming into this world in suspicious circumstances or non-acceptable circumstances, that too could have some kind of effect upon the viability of that prayer, that congregational prayer that is being carried on. And just as you would not put a thalidomide baby to compete in weightlifting, you know, similarly, you would not put them, the person of illegitimate birth, in that particular position.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد صلي على محمد وآل محمد.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
September the 2nd, 2021. I always offered a piece of advice to all officials in previous terms. Time passes quickly, and these 4 years will be over very soon. In his very important governmental decree to Malik Ashtar, the commander of the faithful, alayhi salam, considers all these aspects. I advise all you friends to go take a look at it. It says, then do not keep yourself secluded from the people for a long time. Of course, scholars have put forth other variations and other suggestions for this part. To not seclude oneself. It means that a ruler should not be absent from the people for a long time. Officials cannot, of course, be constantly present among the people, but in some periods of time they should certainly be present. To not isolate oneself from the people means to not lengthen your absence from the people.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
After expanding on this, the commander of the faithful says, if the subjects suspect you of high-handedness, explain to them your position openly. If there is a doubt in the minds of the people about you, you should present your explanations to them and speak to them openly. Notice that the relationship between the ruler and the people should be like this. This relationship is a brotherly and friendly one, and remove their suspicion with your explanation. Nahjul Balagha, letter 53. In other words, if they have a doubt, you should dispel it with your words and your explanations. These were explanations about popularity. Therefore, you should really try to observe these aspects of popularity. Officials in all sectors should have these qualities. The next key word is the administration of justice, which is the basis of the Islamic government and the Islamic Republic. Actually, all religions are based on the administration of justice. God the Exalted says that he sent prophets and heavenly books that people may maintain justice. The Holy Quran, chapter 57, verse 25.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.